Okay, here we are today. Thanks, listeners, for being there. This is Tom Gilligan. Today I have a special guest. Her name is Nan Borton. Nan has had an unusual career. She's worked in refugee camps and things, places related to refugee camps. In today's society, when it's such a controversial subject, I think it's quite fascinating in and of itself. But anyway, Nan is here to tell us some of her experience about working in such, well, conflict situations. So, Nan, why don't you tell us where this started, when you first got exposed to working with, shall I say, refugee camps?
Well, I'm a firm believer in plans. So before I graduated from college, I had planned my whole life so I wouldn't have to worry about anything.
Oh.
And I was going to go to graduate school in historic linguistics, and then I was going to teach.
In historical linguistics?
In historical linguistics,
oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Origins of languages and words.
Really?
And I was going to teach at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
Of course, the University of Michigan knew nothing about this. But I needed to get...
You hadn't announced it to them yet.
I hadn't told them. I hadn't quite shared.
Okay.
But I knew I needed a break after college before going to graduate school, and that was the year that President Kennedy started the Peace Corps.
Oh, yeah. What year was that? 60...
I went in 62.
62,
1962.
Okay.
I believe there were a couple... I believe there were some in 61, but I was still in college. So that was how I was going to... used my break year.
And okay. Just a break of 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I went to Turkey. My then husband and I went to Turkey and taught English. In the course of doing that, I discovered that I really, really loved living overseas, learning other cultures, learning other languages, dealing with kids.
Okay.
All the things that I left out in my life plan.
Wow.
So... my life plan changed, and we decided just to continue to work overseas.
Okay.
And over the years,
I'm curious, how did your life plan change? You just liked it so much? And
I never went back to school.
I never went back to school.
I decided that living life on the ground was really what I was better at.
Life on the ground, I like that.
I would have been a disaster as an academic, I think. But instead, I've led a very activist life and have enjoyed it enormously, despite the obvious difficulties of working in conflict situations and wars.
Working in conflict situations and wars. Well, we'll get to that. Okay, good.
Yeah.
So tell me more. Yeah.
So we wound up going back overseas. I lived, 20 years overseas almost, in Asia and the Middle East. And
so you took a break from Turkey, came back to...
No, finished the Peace Corps assignment. It was 2 years.
Finished your 2 years in the Peace Corps.
Came back to the States.
Okay.
And then Jim and I, you know, did a lot of talking through and decided we wanted to go back overseas.
I'm sorry.
Talking.
Okay.
And decided that we really enjoyed the overseas life, so we went back overseas. I did a number of different things at first.
You'd been offered positions, or you just went over there and...
No. Jim was working with CARE, and I was working with the American Language Center, continuing to teach English as a foreign language. Then we were transferred to India, and in India... we were running a school lunch program in a state just south of West Bengal. And I mentioned that because a lot of my life has been around Bengal, and very happily so. While we were in India, I worked for CARE then as well. And when we were in India, there was what turned out to be the last major land famine in Asia.
Okay, tell us a little bit about CARE, because some of us aren't that familiar with what the CARE did or does.
Just a general overview. For up until the last 7 years of my career, I worked for nonprofit organizations who were involved in international development, relief, reconstruction, and agricultural assistance, education, health. The largest of those hospitals that I worked with was CARE, which is headquartered in Atlanta and has operations in many countries.
Okay, they still exist, I think.
They still exist. All the ones I worked with still exist.
Oh, really?
And later on, I worked with Catholic Relief Services. And then I worked for a long time with International Rescue Committee, IRC, and I worked with them the longest of any one agency.
Where is that based out of?
They're still in New York, and it's a very large, also a large agency that actually specializes in refugees.
Okay.
CARE is more generalist. Catholic Relief Services is more generalist.
Okay, so Nan, you said you worked with these three different agencies, and did you work with individual refugees at some point along the line?
Very much so. I mean, all of these programs were very individual-based. The school feeding program, we actually would be at the schools. We
the school were not feeding doing the feedings. Program?
This
was
in India.
Okay.
While in India, there was a famine, and we went up to help there, and I realized, you know, I discovered that I was fairly good at logistics. Logistics. And I loved doing that kind of work.
Right.
We went then to East Pakistan, as it was then, which had just had a cyclone that killed 700,000 people.
Wow.
And I was working there again with individuals in on one of the severely affected islands.
Can you give me an example of how you worked with individuals, say, during this cyclone period?
In this particular case, there were two aspects to it. One was simply needs assessment and talking to people and going around and working with the government officials. Okay, what's the best kind of stuff we could do? What's the most useful? And then arranging for those things to be brought forward. In this case, it was largely shelter. But while we were there, East Pakistan seceded from Pakistan, and it was a significant and very awful war.
What year was that?
That was 70-71.
Okay.
Now, Bangladesh became independent at the beginning of 71.
Okay.
And that that and the cyclone together killed more than 10 million people.
The war was,
we were there during the war. I've been in several wars now, but that was to me the most frightening because the bad guys had control of the air.
Airstrikes, huh?
Airstrikes, bombing. Yeah. And at that point, Jim and I both started working with individual refugees in West Bengal, India, which is where most of the refugees had gone. And and there it was just simply the grunt work of getting food, moving food, making sure that there were ways that people were able to cook the food.
Okay.
And these were in very informal but very, very functional refugee camps. The United Nations had its best refugee person in charge of that. The government of India was wonderfully involved.
Pretty much there's English-speaking countries there or people there. Was there much trouble with
it? I spoke some Bengali. The Indians who were running things almost all had English.
Okay.
And the refugees would be grouped with someone with the language, or the Indian government officials would speak Bengali to them.
Okay.
We were also in Bangladesh, what became Bangladesh, during that war. Were finally evacuated and then went back at independence.
Are they bombing near you when this is happening?
Oh, yeah.
God. You probably saw some people get...
Well, I spent 2 days under a bed because I was staying right next to the home of the popularly elected prime minister, who was the person that the Pakistanis wanted to get the most. They did not succeed. Yeah, it was serious, and an awful lot of people were killed. But at independence, I started working with a local organization that dealt in resettlement, refugee resettlement, which is one of the best solutions to refugee problems everywhere and one of the rarest you could do because
it's a local...
They can return.
Okay, and how did you describe it again? A local...
This was a local charitable organization, Bangladeshi organization.
Okay.
There were three foreigners, and three of us foreigners worked there, and everyone else was a Bengali.
Wow, that's very interesting. So the best way you can experience is working with a local charitable organization to do
it. It was the best for me at that point because they had, because it was Bengalis helping Bengalis, and a few foreigners who had long been resident in Bangladesh, sort of providing the feedback on needs. So we were able to cover the whole country. We had a very large budget from all over the world. And it was one of the, it was just a wonderful experience because and a rare one. Wonderful place and thing to do.
Okay.
Because it was a wonderful situation and a very rare one where people could return to their own country. That is in the hierarchy of resolving refugee issues. That's the first choice.
To return to their own home.
That's what everybody wishes for them. Mm. It is very rare that it is possible. Because in order to be classified as a refugee, which is a legal distinction that allows certain kinds of funds to flow, it is based on a well-founded fear of persecution.
And so the legal classification is that you have to be out of your home or something? Legally,
you have to be out of your country.
But that's gotten messy,
a lot of this is breaking down. If you are homeless in your home country, you are a displaced person.
Okay.
Those are just strictly legal about where the funds come from.
Okay.
You're displaced within your own country, mm-hmm. which is the work I was doing in Vietnam and Cambodia. Mm. Or you have crossed an international border and you are a refugee, therefore more than likely in a refugee camp.
Okay.
So the distinctions don't matter a whole lot to the person who's suffering. But it is a legal framework that allows aid assistance to flow in an efficient manner.
Okay.
You know who's going to be paying for what. You know who to talk to.
What was your first experience with an actual refugee, if you don't mind, or a family or so? Or what was your...
Well, that's kind of
how
hard.
Did you get your feet in the water, so to speak?
Well, I started getting my feet in the water with all the displaced people in India from the famine in Bihar. And they were in their own country. In order to get food, they moved to camps...
Okay.
Which is not a wonderful solution at all, but it's far and away the easiest way to provide mass feeding, mass medical attention, education. It isn't a solution at all because they're still not in their homes.
Okay.
But it is a way to maintain people until the situation changes and they can go back to their very own homes. This is within their own country.
Hmm. I wonder about camps, because so often you see camps and you think, I see it and I think, oh man, that looks like it's rough and it's getting rougher. But for the people going there, it must be a relief. Yeah.
Well, it's a terrible dislocation.
It is.
But it isn't the only way. It's the major way by which assistance can reach people. I mean, it's no different than seeing the pictures in Houston of the people in the Houston Center. It's exactly the same. They're in their own country. They're in their own city.
Mm-hmm.
They're unable to be in their own homes, and they need to be provided food, sanitation, water, medical attention, and that's just more easily done in a centralized place.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So when you see the film from Houston, what you're seeing are internally displaced people who are benefiting from a fairly well-established system of emergency relief. I mean, you know, you look at those films and you think, oh my God, I don't want to be there.
Oh, right.
So it's not the best in terms of the individual, except for the fact they have access to food and medicine.
A while ago, I heard about Clara Barton, how she got founded, and what I heard was that she tried to get the Red Cross going to get people to cooperate about wars, but people were so tired of hearing about wars that they didn't want to fund it. But when she came up with the idea of national disasters, then a lot of people were on board.
Yeah.
They could empathize with that. Fires that could happen to them, you know, floods. as we see now. So national disasters rather than wars were a much easier way to...
And she was right. I mean, that is still absolutely the case. Of course, it's easier to get funding for your mm-hmm. own people.
Okay.
But the situation I dealt with and many others in international disaster responses, that in general they were countries that didn't have the capacity to do what we see being done in Houston and what mm-hmm. we've seen being done in the natural disasters in this country and in Europe
okay.
and in other developed nations, wealthy okay. nations.
In my experience, a lot of it's on television. You know, I'm not there. But let's say for the listeners out there, for some reason they want to do something. They can send money, we know that. We don't necessarily know where to send the money. Okay.
I will promote doing research on Charity Navigator.
Charity Navigator,
it's an online listing of a very large number of organizations
okay.
that provide relief and assistance, and it rates them by the amount of money that actually gets to the disaster itself as opposed to overhead. So I would just say it's the first step is do your homework, and it's made very easy. There are other sites like that, but that's the one
okay.
I'm thinking of at the moment.
Suppose somebody wanted to actually go and help out. What would you say they should do? They want to go help out with the flood in Texas, say.
Well, I to be perfectly frank, if you're not trained in some form of emergency response, don't go. The first thing I would do if I wanted to do that was contact the Red Cross.
The Red Cross.
Or the Salvation Army.
Okay.
Or any one of those large organizations and see if they can use your assistance.
Oh.
Because it is not just handing out blankets. There are systems and protocols. Not a time to learn whether you want to do this for a career or not.
Nor on-the-job training.
However, there are
yeah.
all sorts of skills are needed.
Okay.
Including, you know, writers and fundraisers and
okay.
all that thing. But I would strongly suggest not going individually, but going through an organization.
Okay.
Just to avoid the chaos. The last thing they need in Houston or in Rwanda or wherever is somebody else they have to look after.
You had a broad range of experiences. What were some of the most difficult ones that you were in and you had to kind of learn the hard way what not to do? I mean, where were your greatest challenges in terms of countries or organizations?
Well, the greatest challenges are I think probably the worst was Rwanda.
Rwanda,
the genocide in Rwanda.
Oh, you were there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
And that was sort of a breakdown of everybody's systems. One of the reasons it was very hard was in order for me to do my job, I had to remain at a slight remove because otherwise it is just so heartbreaking that
yeah.
I would be useless.
I see.
And yet it was heartbreaking. So mm-hmm. that was that, and that is true in every one of these situations I worked in. The necessity of staying slightly apart so that I could do my job.
Oh, how did you do that?
I did it because by then I was a professional and I was working with other professionals.
You were trained.
We had done this, we
mm-hmm.
had taken a great deal of all sorts of specialized training and
mm-hmm.
and I did it because when the disaster was over, I could go fall apart somewhere, but
okay.
but not during the disaster.
Uh-huh.
But the real thing that was a killer for me in Rwanda was I had seen a great many refugee flows, people coming out of refugee camps,
mm-hmm.
coming out of countries in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in a number of places. And the one thing you could always say is that there was a certain amount of noise, just human noise. The people coming out of Rwanda were soundless.
Oh, wow.
And they were with their little animals, the goats. The goats
oh.
were soundless.
Oh.
The kids were soundless.
Oh.
I have never, ever seen anything like that, and I never, ever want to see anything like that again.
Wow.
And that was an extraordinarily difficult situation because the refugee camp was located in a volcanic. There were active volcanoes around the refugee camp. The lake was polluted. The ground, my God, trying to dig latrines in volcanic ground, we had to fly in bulldozers, the biggest bulldozers we could find. And of course, those are two terribly poor countries.
Mm.
But again, human beings, we had all these young children and babies and families had gotten separated. local Congolese women who had babies of their own would be wet nurses for the infants.
Wow.
And it was so incredibly moving how people would just come forward and do everything they could. And any response needs to recognize and capitalize on that.
Say that again now, because that's important. Eh?
Any kind of refugee response or disaster response needs to recognize and capitalize on the ability of people who are already there. And maybe what you do, we paid the women a little money. Anything you can do, they understood the situation way better than any of us. Supporting local effort is just absolutely critical in those situations. Took me a long time to learn, but it really helps to know that how little we know, and that we're surrounded by experts. They just happened not to look like experts.
Admit your own ignorance is a big,
admit your own
big
ignorance.
First step.
Yeah. Okay.
Powerless.
Guys, what do you think we should be doing here?
Okay. Who do you ask? Who do you ask?
Whatever. What if there's anything there to ask? You ask it. Local organizations, local churches, any kind of organization like that. And there is another issue in refugees being outside their own country and getting international assistance, is that in order to prevent the local villagers, for simplicity's sake, I'm doing Rwanda.
Okay.
And we're in eastern Zaire at that point.
Okay.
And there's an enormously large international response. And there are also the villagers who live in eastern Zaire who haven't got much either.
And the Congolese women are the next group
They're part of the villages, the existing villages there. It's important, I find it very important to include the local villagers in whatever's going on, because it helps prevent the resentment. Who are these people from another country who are getting all this assistance? And I've been hungry here for a very long time.
Oh, what a great point. So you cut down on the resentments of your giving aid to some people but not others, huh?
Exactly. And you're also learning from them a lot of stuff, like, yes, I'm hungry, but our local diet doesn't include X, Y, or Z.
So, right.
And that may be a religious restriction, or it may just simply be a cultural one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It helps to know.
So, Nan, as I understand it, you're saying, you know, local is the way to go. And speaking of local, have you worked with relief agencies here in Belfast or anywhere in this area? I would like to hear about that.
I have a Belfast refugee store, and I love it.
Okay.
I have not worked here. All of my qualifications and everything for international work, not domestic.
Okay.
But I worked for a good many years with Indochinese refugees. And I was in Thailand, where our job as a nonprofit organization was to interview there were several hundred thousand refugees.
This was after the Vietnam War. Okay, okay.
And the boat people and...
Right, you were in Thailand?
I was in Thailand. Most of the refugee camps were scattered around Southeast Asia, but the largest ones were in Thailand.
Okay.
We were... the U.S. had decided to admit other nationalities, Cambodians and Lao, as well as Vietnamese. So one of the first things we had to do was survey the refugee camps to find out who was there that might qualify for resettlement in the United States, because there are some strict criteria. And one of the camps where I worked interviewing refugees was in Nong Khai, and it was a camp with in northern Thailand. It was a camp for Lao, mostly lowland Lao as opposed to the Hmong, who were mountain people. And I did that. This was in the late 70s. And you fast forward, and I'm living in Belfast. Saigon fell in 75, so I was in Thailand. I was in Vietnam working with internally displaced during the war. I went back to Thailand in 77, I'm going to say, 76 or 77, to work with the refugees there. It was during that period, so it was probably 1977 when I was in and out of this particular refugee camp. And we fast forward from 1977 to just a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, 2012, something
2000,
like that.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And in Belfast, there opened a Vietnamese, Lao, Thai restaurant. And I went there, of course, been extremely fond of those cuisines. And I went there right away. And there was a Lao woman who was at the counter.
A woman from Laos?
Yeah. And so I asked her when she had come, what refugee camp she had been in. And she had been in the refugee camp that I was working in. We were there at the same time.
In Thailand? She,
in Thailand, wow. In northern Thailand. And she very quickly pointed out she was only 7 years old, so she didn't remember me. But yeah. It is just, you know, that's the kind of story that makes me very, very happy. Because there she is with a wonderful restaurant in downtown Belfast, great-looking kids, fine husband, that's just a wonderful. That's the way it ought always to work.
Oh,
and it
yeah.
just makes me happy.
So here you are, what, 30-something years later,
You
meet somebody who'd actually been there and been a refugee.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, Nan, so for the folks out there who think they might want to get involved in something like that, any kind of refugee or any kind of international aid, what are you suggesting? I think I understand about getting trained. In terms of money, you said the charity...
Charity Navigator. Yeah.
And what if somebody actually wants to go there and do such things? What would you suggest would be a way to go?
Well, I would suggest doing some research on the organizations that do this kind of work. Some are secular, some are religious, some are specific to one or another area, some are broader. Some do very specifically only do one thing. Others do a great many more things.
Okay.
There is a coalition of these organizations called Interaction. They have a website, and you can look up there and see what they are. When I was learning how to do this, there were no academic programs in the United States for it. So I got my union card by... what's called NU's checking, which was following Food for Peace around to make sure it was getting to the proper people. And it was that's how you broke in those days. Now there are all sorts of academic programs. Tufts has a very good one. The University of Wisconsin has a long-term one. But I would still recommend making sure first that this is really something you want to do because it's very difficult.
Okay, that's what I wanted to go to next. Let's say we have to stay in Belfast. There's a lot of great efforts being made locally to help people. What would you say if somebody just wanted to help somebody? They wanted to be in the helping, you know, as a sideline?
We need every single person who's willing to do this to be doing it.
Oh, really? We need people?
Yeah, okay. We do. And if you have a church, that would be a logical place to start. If you don't, I would go, again, to something like Interaction and look at what organizations are very carefully described. The Episcopal Church has international programs.
Okay.
The Catholic Church has international programs.
Okay.
The Methodists did, and I believe still do. I'm sure the UU Church has. And if I did not have are you talking about being involved domestically?
Yeah, just locally. I mean, I'm going to the theme of local. Like, I hate to watch TV because I feel so, can't do anything. And if I wanted to do something here locally, what would I do, you know?
Okay, I don't know. I'm not an expert on that.
Okay.
But I can tell you what I would do, which is I would find a social worker. Or I would go, you know, we have Habitat for Humanity here in town. I would go to them and say, we have a Red Cross. I could go to them.
When you say find a social worker, where would you go to do that?
Well, I'd probably call the University of Maine. Or I would go to the hospital and ask there.
Just seems like so much going on and not enough to do about it. So this is great. How do you look back on this whole experience, Nan, having done this for years and now you're retired and you have friends and so on? How do you look back on this whole experience?
With such gratitude. I was able to have a wonderful career that I think in many cases was helpful to other human beings. I am enormously grateful. I have loved my work. I loved going to work. I loved even the getting on another airplane and going somewhere far away for a long time. I loved all of that because it mattered. I had a great sense of satisfaction that my work made a difference. I also have a real sense of modesty about it was a small difference, but it was the difference that I was able to make.
I see.
And by working through an organization, that ability to help is multiplied and multiplied.
Okay, the working with somebody, the we sort of idea. Yeah, well, that's a great one.
And I don't do that work anymore. I stopped doing it. The last thing I did was that tsunami. But I still support organizations that do it because I really believe in the value that it brings in this world and just overcoming dissension, recognizing humanity, being of some use to others.
Wow, so good to hear. Thank you, Nan. Well, listen, it's been very informative and satisfying to talk with you about this today. Thanks so much for coming and sharing this with the listeners and with me.
Well, thank you.
Okay.